Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hello, this is Jordan Brown, High King of the Noldor, and proud Silmarillionaire. In this week's episode, we discuss Chapter 9 of The Flight of the Noldor, or Don't Let the Door Hit You on the Way Out, Feanor. Topics range from the introduction of the Helcaraxa, the doom of Mandos, the motives and impulses of Feanor, Fingolfin, and the whole Noldor clan to leave Valinor, a brief foray back into Ungoliant, and plenty of Morgoth to go around. This is Feanor's big moment, and we send him out of Valinor properly by questioning his every move, although we do see some Noldor apologists sneak in near the end. We start tonight because, you know, why wouldn't we, with the question, what if Mandos sounded like Droopy Dog?
You know what? Not the first.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Okay, well, let's get straight into things here this evening, because as some of you have already noted, this is a long and very weighty chapter. Jordan suggested maybe we'd need 2 weeks on this chapter. I'm not sure we could do it in 3 weeks, but let's see what we can get through here tonight. Yeah, there's a bunch of Feanor-related topics, and certainly there's a lot of Feanor to talk about here in this chapter. This is Feanor's big moment. Not a great one. Not a good one at all. But his big one, anyway. But before that, Joe, let's start off with your Nienna question before we get too enmeshed in talking about Feanor.
All right, I found it interesting that when Nienna grieves, it seems that there comes healing, and it says that she washed away the defilements of Ungoliant with her tears. It doesn't really heal the trees, but it kind of helps dull everything. And then it also seems that Feanor shows his grief for his father, kind of, in a more rebellious manner, and it kind of brings about some not-as-good things. And I'm wondering, could they do different things, because Nienna was grieving unselfishly and more for everything and everyone, but Feanor was being much more self-oriented and just focusing on his grief for losing the Silmarils and his father?
Yeah, I mean, that is a really interesting parallel. That is the grief of Nienna, which, you know, she's sort of the kind of obvious, I guess she's not a spokesperson, technically. What is she, like a weeps person? I don't know. Anyway, she's the one who's weeping on behalf of all of the Valar and everybody. And I love that image from later on where you've got the Valar there in Valmar, and the Maiar and the Vanyar are standing with them weeping. So there's Nienna, and she's weeping for everybody, but the juxtaposition, as you say, with Feanor, who's weeping, and you know, his own mourning for the death of his father and for the rape of the Silmarils. Tolkien using the word rape in its old sense there, that is basically kidnapping or the taking away. I think that idea of selfish grief is an interesting one, but it's kind of a tricky one, because on the one hand, his weeping for his father is one of the only things that he does which is sort of commended by the narrator in this passage, in this whole chapter, really. You know, when he says on page 79, "For his father was dearer to him than the lights of Valinor or the peerless works of his hands, and who among sons of elves or of men have held their fathers of greater worth?" And one is almost tempted to sort of say, well, like, especially since it's Feanor, I mean, given what we know he thinks about the peerless works of his own hands, then, well, yeah, that's saying a lot to say that he loved his dad even more. So I'm not sure that it's quite exactly fair to say that his grief is selfish, because there I don't think it is, at least not entirely. He's weeping for the Silmarils, and that's, in a sense, a kind of a tainted grief that is tainted with his own pride as well. But not necessarily the grief for his father, but his response to that grief. That's a different story. That is, you know, what when next we see Feanor, he is coming into Tirion, breaking the exile of Manwë, and calling for vengeance. And that's harder. I mean, like that response, that is an arrogant response. He's not responding well to his grief at all. I think that juxtaposition between him and Nienna there is really important. We'll come back to Nienna again next week. Joe, you're certainly right that her grief brings healing, and we'll see, although she cleanses the trees of the poison of Ungoliant, She's not able to restore them, but she is going to be instrumental in helping bring forth the sun and the moon. So when we get to there, we'll see that, and that's interesting. Okay, let's see, Mike, you had a couple simple questions, a few simple words, which I think is really, I'd be happy to clear those up. The first one was perforce, which just means sort of by force. Cozened means deceived. And tithe just means one tenth. So only a tithe of them remained. So only about 10% of the Noldor remained back home in Tirion. 90% of them leave with Fëanor. Though, of course, we should point out many of them, that is Finarfin and his, and many of his followers do turn back and come. And I think they were not in the original tithe. So at the end of the day, it's less than 90% of the Noldor who end up taking off with Fëanor and Fingolfin separately, one by sea and one by land. So that's what tithe means there. Now let's see. Let's go ahead and talk about Fëanor. Let's see, Chris, you wanted to talk about Fëanor's persuasiveness?
Yeah, it just occurs to me I use the word persuasiveness there, but it's obviously much more than that. It's like an exercise of personal power of some kind, and I think it's an interesting trait for anybody to have, whether they be of the Ainur or of the children of Iluvatar. I guess other characters we've seen it in are Saruman. I guess he's another one that has a power of voice like that, and I just find it an interesting power. I guess I'm not sure what point I have to make, but do you agree that it's not just persuasiveness? It's an exercise of power in some fashion.
Yes. I mean, we do see some evidence of like good old fashioned persuasion. That is like in the top of page 84 when we have Galadriel's response. But the words of Fëanor concerning Middle-earth had kindled in her heart. That sort of right. sounds, that's not just him dominating her will. You know, his words have, you know, led her to think of these things, which she really likes. So she's responding to his words. And similarly,
so she seems like she's not taken by the power that he's throwing at them, but by the concepts she's thinking, you know, ties in with her desires.
Right, exactly. And similarly, just a couple lines down in that same paragraph, of like mind with Galadriel was Fingon, Fingolfin's son, being moved also by Fëanor's words, although he loved him little. So he's moved, right? So that, right. again, I think is, you know, we see them being convinced. And, you know, perhaps to some extent, again, even in the next paragraph, at length, after long debate, Fëanor prevailed, and the greater part of the Noldor that there assembled, he set aflame with the desire of new things in strange countries. That, I think, is sort of starting to move in a stronger direction there. That is, you know, he is setting them aflame with desire. I think we can see something different here between that and the words of Fëanor kindling in Galadriel's heart. I think mainly because of the clause that immediately comes after, for she yearned to see the wide unguarded lands. That is, there's already a desire in her heart which resonates with this, you know, so her, you know, to sort of...
I think it's kind of...
Go ahead.
I just think it's kind of in the nature of the Noldor themselves that they're doers. And so I can imagine, even if all this didn't happen, that eventually they'd say, you know what, we want to do something else. Let's go. So I think I'm going to guess that within the Noldor psyche itself, it's Fëanor's words and the idea of leaving. I think that it probably appeals at some level to most of them because they, I think, as a people, want to be out doing things. They're makers, so they're stranded in Valinor, even though they don't really perceive it as being stranded. But I can see them wanting to move out regardless of what this happened eventually.
Yes, there's a really telling moment when they refer to Middle-earth as home in this, you know, let us go home, which I think does really speak to that and to the trend that we've, you know, sort of the theme, which I think is a pretty subtle theme and you can miss it pretty easily. But that is the Valar kind of screwed up in inviting the elves to Valinor in the first place theme, which I think, you know, definitely does come into play here again, you know, that we can see that there is... The desire of the Noldor to leave is not entirely and in all ways corrupt. You know, as you say, there are ways in which Feanor's words are wrong in spirit, but they're not entirely inaccurate. The Noldor are, in fact, literally hemmed in a narrow place, as he says. Now, you know, they're not being held prisoners, and they're not thralls, and you know, when he talks about the cage of the Valar and stuff, I mean, that's unfair. But they were meant to be, I mean, they seem to be meant to be with their skills of making, to be blessing all of Arda. And they're not. They just have their little city and their little valley and the mountains of Valinor, and that's... So yeah, I mean, I think that there is something at least not bad about their desire to go back. But at the same time, all the way through, it is continually shot through here to a greater or lesser extent with negative desires, with corrupt desires. You know, Fingon's desire to return, well, that seems to be okay, but a little bit corrupted. Galadriel's even more corrupted. I mean, she wants to rule a realm at her own will. She seems to desire mastery. That's a little questionable. But
yeah, I'd say her of all of them, her motivations are as much suspect as anybody. I mean, other than Feanor and his sons, but her. I mean, she wants things to order things in her own way, and that's a little bit tainted as far as motivation goes.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's, and that's, this is a moment which is almost never going to come up again. I mean, Galadriel is a very minor player in the Silmarillion. She'll come up again a couple times, we'll meet her again, but she's never going to do very much. But the moments when she does come up, and especially this is the absolute number one moment for Galadriel, prior to the business about the Third Age, of course, the very last section of the book. But prior to that, this is the moment, the most important Galadriel moment. And the best thing to do with this moment is just kind of file that away. If you read this sentence about Galadriel in the Silmarillion, the whole scene with Galadriel and Frodo makes a lot more sense.
I was just going to refer to that, because that whole conversation she has with Frodo is put in a completely different context when you think back to this.
Yeah. I mean, that is, she is finally being, you know, and this is why she says, I passed the test. You know, this is the final moment when she is then, only then, when she refuses to take the Ring of Power, is she finally at last completely turning her back on this moment. Yeah, you know, the thing that she did way back before they left Tirion, right here in this moment, she is now finally, for the first time, completely putting that desire for mastery behind her, because she had the opportunity and she makes the choice not to, and that's why she immediately links it. I mean, her words there, you know, I passed the test, I shall diminish and go into the west and remain Galadriel. And those are, like, all three of those things. All three of those statements are significant. She shall diminish. That is, she's not going to seek her own elevation. She's not going to try to make more of it. She's going to submit. She's going to be humble. She's going to submit to becoming less and not try to become more as she wants to become more. She's going to be able to go into the West. She wasn't permitted to go into the West before. Now she's going to be able to go into the West because she's passed the test. The Valar will now take her back. And she'll remain Galadriel. You know, she knows what happens to people who actually are overcome by the desire for mastery. I mean, even if she had only seen it in Feanor, she would know what happened. I mean, she wasn't there when Feanor, you know, meets his end. The last she saw of, you know, Feanor, he was like on the deck of a white swan ship cackling maniacally as he sails off into the distance. But still, I mean, even there, she's already seen him and how he has become corrupt. She's going to remain Galadriel. So anyway, yeah, that's sort of a huge thing. And I'm glad we brought that up. There's not too much more to say about Galadriel because, again, she only gets the one sentence. But it is noteworthy. And then, of course, Feanor is the greatest example of someone whose desire to go back is sort of thoroughly corrupted. But you know, when I say thoroughly corrupted, I don't mean 100% evil, just as his statements are not completely inaccurate.
Right.
So, and this is, you know,
pride leading to the oath. Then yeah. After the oath, I mean, everything he does is tainted.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think we talked last time when we were looking at Ungoliant, especially at, you know, the nature of evil as Tolkien depicts it in his books. And I still say Ungoliant, and her end is described in the beginning of this chapter. I mean, again, she is the paradigm of evil. And I can't believe in all the things that people have suggested they want to talk about. You know, after are we satisfied? Are we glutted with Ungoliant from last week? No one has even mentioned her. anyway, the point is, in this chapter, you know, if in last chapter we see this sort of like pure distilled version of what evil is, in this chapter I think we see, as much as anywhere in all of Tolkien's writings, the delicacy with which Tolkien treats the relationship, like the complex interweaving of good desires and bad desires, the way in which evil desires corrupt good people and good intentions and good actions and good powers. You know, we see in Feanor really almost like step by step a good person going bad. And it is remarkably well done, I think. It's really neat. Mm-hmm. And really moving. And this is something I'd even sort of thinking back to Joe's comment about his grief at the beginning, you know, something that I would add there too, that, you know, they not to overlook the fact many there grieved for the anguish of Feanor, we're told, but his loss was not his alone. So they're not just weeping for him, but they are weeping for him too. That is, that they're sad for him. People have compassion for Feanor. And we'll see them weeping for Feanor again in a couple of chapters from now. And that's
sorry about
I think
that.
That's okay. And that's a really big deal. Go ahead.
Trying to keep baby Han here, my puppy, quiet and then the darn phone. And sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Yes, I was actually impressed that your puppy had allowed you to talk for so long without inflicting damage upon you, or maybe you're just bearing it very nobly.
Well, he's very small, and I've got him under my arm, so he can't move right now.
That's good. Here, I've been sort of prattling on here, and a couple other people I know wanted to weigh in on this. Elizabeth, you wanted to say something before, I think?
Yeah, you already touched on it, I think, but just in terms of the persuasiveness of Feanor, I was really struck when I was reading this about how much actual fact or truth was in what he was saying. It was really twisted, of course, but in his speech in Tirion, he was talking about how the Valar could not protect them from the enemy, which was in fact true, and how they had begrudged the light to Middle-earth, which was also true, and how they were being kind of dragging their feet in pursuing Melkor, which I'm sure that they had their reasons for, but, you know, was also really true. And so it's, you know, when you have a lot of truth behind, or a lot of fact, I guess, behind your argument, it just makes it really persuasive. So that gave him a lot of power.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that I'm glad that you brought up those specific claims, because I think all of those are really interesting. I mean, there really is, you know, in the middle of what begins to just sound like a rant, and, you know, you're just, one is tempted to say, oh, you know, Feanor, you're being totally unfair. The Valar they've blessed you. They've not cursed you. You know, they're doing, but, you know, you're right. All of those things that you mentioned have truth in them. Even the denying the light to Middle Earth. I mean, it's easy for us. You know, we look at Feanor locking away the Silmarils and denying the sight of the Silmarils to people at festivals, and we say, oh, how selfish, look at Feanor, he's already becoming corrupt, and he is, and that is bad. But, you know, gosh, that kind of strikes home there. The Valar do something kind of similar. The light which they are enjoying, and which they've brought the elves over to enjoy, the rest of Middle-earth is not being the rest of Middle-earth is in a sense being denied it, as they, you know, sort of do their own little, you know, neighborhood thing over there and kind of neglect the rest of Middle-earth. So anyway, I think that I'm really glad that you mentioned that. Okay, well, let's go on to Mike. You had a couple Feanor observations you wanted to make.
Well, first, quickly, we talked about Feanor and the red helmets that he builds for himself and his people a couple of chapters back. And now we see him drawing his red sword in this chapter, or his people drawing their red swords in the firelight. And I just like the contrast of the red again, especially against the white ships of the Teleri when he encounters them. I thought that was just a great contrast. But the other thing I wanted to mention about Feanor as a sub-creator and as an example of how certain sub-creators can go wrong was that he doesn't seem to have a lot of empathy for the other sub-creators he encounters in this chapter, Yvanna Aule, and Olwe. Yvanna is a sub-creator. She's lost her creation. He doesn't have to seem to have much empathy for her. Aule tries to, tries to step in during that first debate and give him a little breathing room, and he doesn't seem to recognize that that's going on. And finally, when he encounters Olwe and has that argument with Olwe, Olwe makes the argument, these ships are our sub-creation. I mean, can't you relate to the way we feel about our ships is how you feel about your gems? And again, he doesn't seem to have any empathy for that argument. So here is an example of a sub-creator goes wrong when he no longer has empathy or compassion for his fellow being sub-creations.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's really in line with what we've seen with, sub-creators going bad, as we've, been looking at now for several weeks. One of the main patterns that we see, which of course Feanor has already been exemplifying, is losing focus and sort of just focusing in on his own work, that is like, to love too much the work of his own hands, right? When his own love gets just locked in the Silmarils and he becomes obsessed with them, and to love them with a greedy love and a selfish love. But I think that what you're pointing to, Mike, this lack of empathy with other sub-creators, is sort of the natural extension of that. That is, when you cease to be, as a sub-creator, humble in the way that Aule is humble and proves himself to be humble, the way that the Noldor were humble at first in their making of gems and giving them away and strewing them around on the streets and the beaches, and, that was a good thing. That was sort of the right way to be. Well, then you not only, when you're just taking delight in the craft and taking delight in the craft of others, therefore, as well. But when that focus begins to be selfish, you don't really care. And I agree. I mean, because it's the argument that Olwe makes is not just, hey, we're sub-creators, you can relate to us, but these ships are our Silmarils. He repeats back to Feanor almost exactly the speech that Feanor just made to the Valar, to the great, to the lesser as well as the greater. There are some things that they can only do once. Well, yeah, that's exactly what Olwe says to him. You might not respect this. These ships might not seem like anything to you compared to your flashy Silmarils, but these are our Silmarils.
Right, and I like the way that Olwe lays out maybe three or four arguments in sequence as to why what you're doing is wrong, but that last one is the topper.
Yeah, and it seems to be like a carefully calculated topper. Like, Feanor, I'm going to try to, speak your language here, okay? surely you can, if any being on Earth can understand this, you can, right? But he doesn't. And this is why, to me, it's, I think, very revealing. And sort of the culminating atrocity, the burning of the ships. The burning of the ships is one of the things that I think is one of the most pure. I mean, in some ways, I actually find the burning of the ships almost more tragic than the kinslaying. It's not like it matters more, because it doesn't. And certainly the kinslaying is like the crime that's going to be hanging over the heads of the Noldor. But I was always saddened more by the burning of the ships than I was by the kinslaying. And that, I think, is really the moment when you can see Feanor he's gone. He's just gone completely over the edge.
Since you're mentioning the burning of the ships, could you define Fey, F-E-Y, Feanor laughing as one Fey at that moment?
Yeah. He's Fey twice. Or he'll be Fey again in the next chapter. Or not the next chapter, but the next time we see him. Anyway, he is... Fey means to be, it's like a subset of crazy. It's when you're out of your mind, but particularly when you're out of your mind in a way which is anticipating and or seeking death. Like he is, he laughed as one who is Fey. Other people who will be Fey in Tolkien, Frodo is going to be called Fey when he is running up the pass of Cirith Ungol after they escape from Shelob's lair, and he's like shouting and his voice is echoing around, and he's like, one more bit, Sam, and we'll be free. And Sam is, you know, looking around and he puts the file away. Frodo is described as Fey there. Pippin uses the word Fey to describe Denethor. When he is appealing to Baragon for help, he says, "Your master is Fey and dangerous." And Eowyn, of course, is also Fey at the Battle of Pelennor Field. So those are sort of illustrations. It's not just, it's a special kind of out of your mind. So that's what Fey means in that context. Of course, Fey also can mean relating to fairy or a kind of something that is like, it can be like an adjective form referring to fairies. This is not that kind of Fey. I always want to make sure that there's no confusion there. Let's see. Somebody just wanted to contribute to the let's see, Dave, you wanted to talk about the Yavanna and Feanor's reaction to their creations. I think that's sort of relevant here when thinking about, you know, sub creators gone wrong here.
Sure. I think actually we kind of covered it, because my point was sort of along the same lines as the thing about Feanor having no empathy for other sub creators' work. But actually, I guess maybe I'll add a little bit to it. I just thought it was very interesting. You sort of notice initially a natural parallel between Yavanna's lamenting the fact that the trees are dead, and she sort of says, like, I can't just make new ones, you know, that was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime creation, but if I had the light, I could remake them. Feanor follows right up with, yeah, well, my Silmarils are once-in-a-lifetime creation, too, and sure, I can give them to you, but I'll never be able to, that will be the end of them. There's a certain impatience that comes out in Tolkas, and I think the reader probably feels it too, you know, like, yeah, well, Feanor, come on, man, get on with it. Yvonne is asking nicely, and Ali jumps in and says, like, hey, wait a minute, you know, these things are no less precious to him than the trees were to Yvonne, so let's back off, which I think is reasonable. I think the difference here is that Yvonne is not asking Feanor to give up the Silmarils so that she can get back her trees, because the trees weren't something that she hoarded and kept to herself, that she valued in and of themselves because she created them. I mean, she did value them as creations of her own hands, but mostly her concern is for everybody else, for the world, for the people and the creatures and all of creation that sort of enjoyed the light of the trees. And I think where the parallel or analogy between her and Feanor breaks down is that Feanor is not acting out of thought for other people. He's turning inward. He's acting out of his own selfish desire. That in the end, you know, even though he's being asked to do something awful, it's not like he's being asked to give up something of his to get something for Yavanna. He's being asked to take one for the team, to for everyone else, to revive the light of the trees, not so that Yavanna can see her creation restored, but rather so that the world can have light again. And even though it's hard for him in rejecting that, ultimately his decision to reject it is a selfish one, and that's really sort of where he goes wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's a really good way of putting it. Feanor seems to see almost as if, like, this is a question of your creation or mine, right? And Yavanna does not seem to be seeing it in those terms, and I don't think anybody else is really seeing it in those terms. I agree. I think that is a really fruitful way to think about the contrast between the two of them. I do like the fact... Mike, I think you had mentioned this before, just the little bit that we get from Aule there, you know, a really good reminder, you know, when Mr. Sub-Creator Valar steps in, essentially to give a cue, even if nothing else, to give a cue to us, the readers. Somebody I just saw was just commenting in the text chat about, you know, sort of having sympathy for Tolkas's attitude. And I can certainly sympathize sympathize with Tolkas there. And Dave, you were just saying also that, you know, we might think the same thing. So we get Aule's voice there to say, guys, don't be too quick here. And I think that this applies to the other Valar, but also to us as readers, too. It's not a no-brainer. This is a big deal. Because these are the greatest work of hands that ever will be made by a child of Iluvatar. So to destroy them, it would be a good act, but it would be a very costly good act. Now, I don't think that, though I have to say, although granting that, I still think that Fëanor is being a little melodramatic. That is, you know, he says, if I unlock my jewels, you know, if I break them, I shall break my heart and I shall be slain. Really, Fëanor? I don't know. Maybe you think that way. But, you know, if he did, sounds unfair to say it would be his own fault, but basically, I think that would be a symptom of his disease. His heart should not be so locked within his own creations that if he gives them up, he dies. Like, that's if that's true, that's a bad sign. And I'm not even 100% sure it's true.
Yes, that is an indication of an unhealthy level of attachment to the jewels.
Yeah, yeah. Either one. That is, either if it's true or if it's not true. Both, like, if he just thinks that or if it's actually true. Neither way is it a good thing. I think that's important. Matt, you had asked sort of in passing, in response, I think, to what I said before about Fëanor being good and going bad in this chapter, and you had sort of asked in passing, was Fëanor ever good? Yes, he was. Now, it's true that we never see him doing noble deeds and stuff like that, but I do think it's important to remember he does start off good. He becomes corrupted over time. He has, at the very least, the potential to have been the greatest in every way. And we'll come back to this. We will see this more explicitly emphasized a few chapters down the road. But there is no question that he has been given by Iluvatar great, great power for good, and he was, to some extent, using it for good. Even if, you know, we can see his, like, you know, remember one, you know, the glimmers that we get of that, you know, in his junior high science fair project, that is the alphabet, the Fëanorian alphabet, you know, that's, we can see, even just there, a glimpse of what he could have accomplished, you know, the kinds of, if he had just remained the kind of maker that he was at the beginning. I think that we have to sort of accept, as a paradigm anyway, that he is good or potentially good, and we see him becoming increasingly corrupt, and this chapter is the rapid decline. Now, Nick, you wanted to comment on or ask a question about Fëanor not giving up the Silmarils?
Yeah, I have a technical question on subcreation. When Fëanor was asked to give up the Silmarils, he responded with, "It may be that I can unlock my jewels, but never again shall I make they alike. And if I must break them, I shall break my heart, and I shall be slain." Now, with what I understand from subcreation, when somebody subcreates something, some part of their essence or spirit is put into that creation, like with Sauron, with the rings. So I'm wondering if this is the same. At the end of Lord of the Rings, when the ring is destroyed, is Sauron completely annihilated, or is he just diminished in power to such an extent that he's not a worry? But also with Yavanna, her creation was the trees, and they were destroyed, and yet it doesn't seem as though that she's diminished in power at all. So is it true that if the Silmarils truly are destroyed, will Fëanor die because of that, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because that is a really neat parallel. It is, you know, when we're looking at the Silmarils through the rest of this book, it's going to be hard not to be thinking about the Rings of Power, at least to some extent. I mean, certainly there are some parallels. Now, the power of the Silmarils themselves is not much like the Rings of Power. But there does seem to be that connection. I mean, that is a really interesting parallel between Fëanor talking about his own sort of life being tied up with them. But I think there it's different. And here I think is the difference. And I think actually in pointing out that Yavanna's own life essence doesn't seem to be tied to the trees, even though they were her, you know, magnum opus, I think that that actually really points to what the difference really is. And what I'd say about that is, basically, if it's true, and this is why I don't really think it's true of the Silmarils, it was of the Ring of Power, what we see there, what we see Sauron doing, is evil. And it's, I don't want to make it sound really simple, like evil magic works one way and good magic works another way. But actually, that's kind of true. I wouldn't talk about good and bad magic, but in the sense of like what the nature of good is and what the nature of evil is. Let's go back to Morgoth on Ungoliant here for a second. At the bottom of page 80, we're told Ungoliant had grown great, and he less by the power that had gone out from him. Morgoth, who is now officially Morgoth because Fëanor has named him that, Morgoth is lesser now. He has decreased because of the power that he has expended, the power that he put into her to help her with the darkening of Valinor. We don't see that happening with good guys. They don't get diminished in power. And we will, you know, we see also, let's see, where is it? Where we talk about Morgoth being, losing forever his power to, I'm not finding the passage. The passage where it mentions Morgoth losing the power to change his shape. Darn it, where is that? Thought it was right here. Oh well. I hate it when I can't find the passage. Let's see, what is that, Chris? Top of page 82? Yeah. I think
it starts at the bottom of 81, maybe.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. For now, more than in the days of Itumno, ere his pride was humbled, his hatred devoured him, and in the domination of his servants, and the inspiring of them with lust of evil, he spent his spirit. Nonetheless, his majesty as one of the Valar long remained, though turned to terror, and before his face all save the mightiest sank into a dark pit of fear. The business about his losing the power to change his shape was in the last chapter, right, because he went unclad and was invisible through Valinor. Anyway, sorry, Chris, you're right, that was the passage that I was thinking of. So what we see here is that when evil puts forth its power to dominate others, it is lessened by that. Like, that's how it works. And when Sauron puts forth his power to dominate people and makes the One Ring, to facilitate his dominion of others, especially the elves and the other rings of power, he has to put his own self, his own power into that, and that makes him lesser. When good people, when Aule subcreates things, when Yavanna brings things, brings growing things to life and growth, they are not lessened by that. They are not decreased. They don't spend their power. They don't become less. They don't fade. Morgoth fades. He spent his spirit. And so, Sauron is decreased. When the Ring of Power is destroyed, spoiler, at the end of the War of the Rings, Ring of Power is destroyed. When the Ring of Power is destroyed, Sauron does become much, much, much lesser. And he's not completely annihilated, but he is made way less. And that's basically how he brought about his own destruction. That's Sauron's own little version of Ungoliant at last consuming herself. Again, Ungoliant, the perfect paradigm of evil. How Ungoliant dies is what always happens to evil people. At last, in her uttermost famine, she consumed herself. All evil creatures end that way. And this is not because Tolkien is like simplistically causing all of his evil characters to come to the same destructive end. This is because Tolkien is saying that's what evil is. That's what it means to be evil, is to be ultimately self-destructive. If you are being evil, all you're doing, like, what evil is sawing off the branch that you're sitting on. I mean, this is one of the things that Iluvatar is trying to explain to Melkor. I was going to say from day one. It's way before day one, right after the Great Music. So all evil creatures end up consuming themselves. Ungoliant, in that perfectly illustrative way. We will see Morgoth do it. We will see Sauron do it. We will see Gollum do it. I mean, it happens to everybody. So So yeah, I think that that's kind of a big deal. But then now going back, Nick, to the point that you were making about the Silmarils here, again, if it were true, it would be bad, not just bad about Fëanor, but bad about the Silmarils too. And I think in as much as he is lessening himself, it shows that Fëanor too is spending his spirit doing things that he shouldn't be doing. You know, that is an unnatural application of the spirit in that way. So I think that parallel is a really suggestive one. Matt, go ahead.
No, we were just on Melkor there, and I just thought it was so brilliantly ironic that he crawls in this big hole in the ground, crowns himself, and calls himself king of the world.
Yes.
Just seems ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah. Especially since in that same place we're told that he's never going to leave his cave again. You know, and so, I mean, that's just kind of funny. Yeah, I agree. He's going to be decreasing.
He's getting weaker and weaker all the time. And, you know, and yet he still has this delusion of grandeur.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. I am the ruler of all I survey. You know, okay, it's not much, but I'm the ruler of all the stuff that's out there that I'm no longer a part of anymore. There's something deeply deluded. But again, that also is very much, you know, part of the nature of evil in Tolkien as well. Self-delusion, that is. Yeah. Joe, go ahead.
All right, no, I'm just talking about Morgoth for a second. It made me think of if he would have been like the good kings that you see, if he would have actually gone out and like led his army and things, and if he would have been the leader on the field, like you see Lord of the Rings a lot, that there's like much more success there. Like even in like the Battle of Lord of the Rings, where, you know, Sauron comes out and starts fighting, that almost turns the tide, and he gets his finger cut off. But so it just seems like, I mean, if he would have been able to step up and do that, things could have been a ton differently. But then I guess that, in essence, is kind of his cowardice and being evil. I'm not sure how that works, but I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, when in the end Morgoth is finally overcome, spoiler alert, Morgoth is going to be overcome. Anyway, when in the end he's finally overcome, we will see he is going to be cowering. I mean, he's going to be craven, you know, to use the word that Fëanor uses twice, you know, in one of his big speeches. You know, we will not suffer from cravens or the fear of cravens. It's kind of ironic. He himself, Morgoth himself, is going to be called Craven at the end. Well, he's going to be called Craven a couple times, but he in the end will show cowardice. So yeah, I agree. That's a big deal. Okay, let's see. Jordan, you had actually we just touched on Ungoliant. Jordan, you had wanted to ask an Ungoliant question.
Yeah, I you actually covered my main question. I was going to make a Pizza the Hut reference, so basically covered away.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Did you want to talk about Fingolfin?
And how absolutely amazing and fantastic he is? Yes, I would love to talk about that.
Well,
I am just
that.
Blown Excellent. Away time and time again, and it really starts in this chapter with how great Fingolfin is, and I just love him very much.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, to follow up on the Fingolfin discussion we had last week, I think that we can see here evidence of what I was trying to point to last time, which is, although Fingolfin does step up and say, you know, though half-brother in blood, full brother in heart, I will be where you go, I will follow, that doesn't bind him. When Fëanor is, you know, starting to do his obviously sketchy things here and, you know, actually saying, hey, let's revolt against the Valar, Fingolfin never once says, well, I said I would go along with you, so I will. He does, but the reason he goes along with him is not because he's agreeing to follow him, I'm not going to be your puppy dog, but that would be kind of ironic in light of the non-meek following along of Chris's puppy dog. But anyway, he's not just tagging along with Fëanor at all. He's coming with him in order to oppose him. He's coming with him to help protect the other Noldor from him, from Fëanor. So at no point is he just like, well, I guess I have to go along with Fëanor. So, I mean, I think that that's, that's really pretty clear. Fingolfin does very well. He is one of the opponents, the biggest opponents of Feanor, all the way through this. Of the other Noldor, that is other than Feanor's own sons, there are several who are kind of with him. I mean, we saw Goadriel and Fingon to some extent, and Finrod to some extent also. And then you've got Finarfin and Orodreth, who are trying to make everybody be at peace, but Fingolfin is standing up to him. And you'll notice the other one who's with him there primarily is Turgon. Turgon is the one who is like shoulder to shoulder with Fingolfin, disagreeing with Feanor and opposing him. And I think that's an important thing to remember. There's going to be an interesting kind of aberration, or not exactly, I don't think it's necessarily an aberration, but Turgon's going to end up being considered High King later on, and I think that's kind of an interesting thing, as from a lineal perspective, that doesn't necessarily make sense. But I think that I would just, when we get to that, I would just sort of say, remember this moment. Turgon is one of the ones here showing some real leadership side by side with his awesome daddy Fingolfin, and I think that's a good thing to remember when we get there. I see a raging debate about which is really the more awesome character among several very awesome characters is breaking out in the chat over here. I'm not going to weigh in on that now, since several of those are related to much later in the book stuff. Let's see. Jack, you wanted to talk about the oaths?
Yeah, and... Oaths, I guess that's just something I don't fully understand, the mechanics of the oath, what the literary references or what Tolkien is thinking when he's saying oath. Feanor is making an oath here, but an oath, he's using Manwë as a witness, but is it an oath to Iluvatar? Is it just an oath to whoever? Just how does it all work? And it seems to be taken very seriously in Lord of the Rings. And what the consequences are, I don't know, of breaking the oath. I mean, if we see in Lord of the Rings, I don't know the full mechanics, but there seems to be the dead people that the Aragorn eventually releases. I mean, the consequences seem to be severe. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that is something, oath taking and oath keeping were extremely important in Anglo-Saxon and Norse cultures, and you can see that there's that kind of a flavor to oaths, really. I think pretty much throughout Tolkien's works. Just to give a few illustrations, and you've touched on several of them, Jack, I think that are really important. When we'll sort of work back from these to Feanor's oaths. In The Lord of the Rings, we see, I would point to Faramir talking to Frodo and saying, I said, not if I found it, by the highway, would I take it? And he said, and although I didn't know what I was talking about, I would take that as an oath and keep it. And so, I mean, the way that Faramir refers to oaths there shows that in his mind, if you've sworn an oath, then, I mean, it's like, it is completely binding. And even if you find out later that, and even if there are extenuating circumstances, it doesn't matter. So you can see the way that he talks about it, the kind of assumptions he makes about how serious the taking of an oath is. We see an illustration of this also in the skeleton that Aragorn finds in the Paths of the Dead. That is Baldur, the son of Brego, who built the Hall of Meduseld, and who at the feast, the celebration feast of Meduseld, swore an oath that he would walk the Paths of the Dead. I was probably heavily drunk at the time, but had to keep it, and did, and died, because he couldn't open the door, because he wasn't the one who could open the door. But anyway, he had to keep his oath, even though he died. Now, of course, we have, as Mike is pointing out here in the text chat, we have a couple of formalized oaths that we see being taken. That is the oath that Denethor administers to Pippin when he takes his oath to become a member of the guard. We have, of course, the oath that Eorl takes, in which Éomer repeats, reestablishes with Aragorn. Those are some really important things. I would go back, Jack, to the point that you made about the dead people in the Paths of the Dead. I mean, their oath is so strong, is so binding to them, that not even death can interfere with it. Not even death cancels it. In fact, not only does death not cancel it, but the power of that oath actually like transcends death and keeps them, locks their spirits there. Until they fulfill their oath, they cannot have peace. So anyway, I mean, and those are the ones, the oath breakers, as Aragorn calls them, are some of the only people that we see who break oaths. So apparently that was a big deal. That was obviously a big deal. Now, coming back to Feanor's oath, note, this is on page 83, notice that the first thing we're told about it is that it's a terrible oath. So even as oaths go, this is a really terrible one. And I think terrible in two ways. Terrible because of how serious and how solemn it is. There are clearly, like, I guess there clearly can be degrees of oaths. Faramir saying something off the cuff, which he would have held to as an oath, is clearly very different from the oath that Pippin takes, that is the formal oath that he swears, different from the formal oath that was sworn, the formal oath of allegiance sworn by Eorl, which he kept, sworn by, you know, the men of the mountains to Isildur, which they broke, and that's why they're ghosts now. And this is, like, very, very, very high on the scale of very serious oaths. So he swore a terrible oath, and his seven sons take it, swear it with him. They swore an oath which none shall break, and none should take, by the name even of Ilúvatar, calling the everlasting dark upon them if they kept it not. And Manwë they named in witness, and Varda and the hallowed mountain of Tenequitil, vowing to pursue with vengeance and hatred. Well, let's wait till we get to the terms of, we get to what they actually promise, and look at the setting of it. They swear it by the name of Ilúvatar. They call Manwë and Varda as witnesses of the oath, and the hallowed mountain of Tenequitil, and they call the everlasting dark upon them if they don't keep it. That's huge. Like, these, like, it's, you, there aren't any stronger terms that they could bind themselves under. They couldn't be more absolutely bound in any other way. So this is like, so even before we get there, we have the just the absolute solemnity of this vow. This is a completely unbreakable vow. Now, what are they promising exactly? What are they swearing? Vowing to pursue with vengeance and hatred, not just vengeance and hatred, to the end of the world, Vala, demon, elf, or man as yet unborn, or any creature, great or small, good or evil, that time should bring forth unto the end of days, whoso should hold or take or keep a Silmaril from their possession. See, it was bad enough when he was saying, you know, on the previous page, vengeance calls me hence. That's not very good. His desire for vengeance is already a little shaky, but this goes way beyond that. This is, the vow is the ultimate expression of Feanor's selfishness. The Silmarils are mine. And think of the language that Morgoth uses about them. I name them unto myself forever. Feanor's already doing that. I mean, he's doing the same thing that Morgoth is doing, but he's formalized it. I name them unto myself and anybody. This is no longer about taking vengeance against Morgoth. I'm not taking vengeance against Morgoth because he's evil. I swear, good or evil, anybody, for any circumstances, for any reasons, Vala, demon, elf, or man, to the end of time, who tries to keep my things away from me, I will pursue them with vengeance and hatred. That's a huge deal. And again, so we have that selfishness, which was already the first sort of signs of his starting to go bad. Now he's locked that in, and he has locked himself to it. And, you know, in my mind, one of the most painful things that we see later on in the story is the couple of the sons of Feanor who are not complete jerks, who are trapped by this vow, and they can't stop themselves, and they can't get out of it now. That's a huge deal. So this is as bad as it gets. And I'll want to remember back to this conversation when, like, 3 months from now, we get to the very end of the Quintus Silmarillion, because we will see Maglor and Maedhros debating this exact point. They're like, hey, how about we just break the oath? And they're like, I don't think really that's an option. So anyway, I think that it's very cool. It's very important. Let's see. Dusty, you wanted to talk about the doom of the Noldor?
I was talking about the doom of the Noldor, even kind of before it happened. It almost seemed preordained. And when the Noldor left and went back to Middle-earth, the Valar didn't seem to have anything to do with Middle-earth other than to go over there and beat the crap out of Melkor. Had they been doing anything? Was it not already abandoned? With them putting the Noldor under the ban of the Valar, would it have made a difference anyway?
Wait, so would it... I'm not sure I'm 100% following you here. Would what have made any difference?
The Valar doing anything in Middle-earth to begin with. When was the last time they went over there? I mean, Middle-earth has been in darkness all this time. The fact that it's now under ban, what were they doing when it wasn't under ban?
In some ways, that makes the... You know, you sort of think, you know, I think back to what we were talking about before, and Elizabeth, the point that you were making about the truths or half-truths in Feanor's big speech in Tirion, you know, the actions of the Valar make their, really kind of undermine their position here, in exactly, Dusty, I think some of the ways that you're suggesting. When they say they want to go back, you know, Manwë's like, you know, freely you came over, freely you can return, that's fine, you know, go ahead and do that. But, you know, in the Middle Earth as it really is, there has been made a real difference because of the darkness, because the light has been, you know, sort of gathered over in Valinor, and they've walled themselves in over there, and so much of their time and attention is focused over there. The result is, you know, they're really, you know, on Arda, we really do have the haves and the have-nots, and they really are, the Noldor, that is, in returning to Middle-earth, really are kind of moving to the second-class area to some extent. I think that's an important thing. And I think that that is interesting.
While the Noldor are under the ban of Valar, what about the Sindar and all the other innocent elves that are kind of just left on their own to suffer all this time and because of what the Noldor did?
Yeah, and that's going to be really interesting. I mean, I think that's going to be really interesting to look at, and we'll see that both in next week's class and also I think it's the third week from now. That is the chapter that's called "Of the Return of the Noldor." The situation that the Sindar are in. The next chapter is going to be a meanwhile in Middle-earth. Here's what's been going on, and we'll see. They're in trouble over there. They're really suffering. And that's only the part where the Sindar are. I mean, goodness knows how things are now way out to the east, where there aren't even that many elves anymore because of the migration. So things are getting ugly, and the Noldor returning to that in some ways is a good thing. It's not hard to see that this is, you know, one can look at it from a certain angle, which sounds almost like, yeah, the Noldor are right and the Valar are wrong there. The Noldor should return. That's a good thing. They are right to rebel against the Valar. You know, it almost like sounds like one could say, now I don't think you can really maintain that argument. The attitude and spirit with which they go is clearly not a good thing, and not something the story is commending. But I think that to some extent, you can actually kind of maintain that. Joe, what you wanted to ask about something else about Feanor, I think?
It just seems like what's really driving Feanor seems to kind of change as he progresses throughout this chapter. Like at first, the vow, I mean, it's mainly about the Silmarils, and I mean, you know, he curses Morgoth because the Silmarils and his father. It mostly just seems to be about the Silmarils and recovering them. But then, as it progresses and he ends up abandoning Fingolfin, you wonder what the reasoning is behind that. It seems like he realizes Fingolfin could be a kind of like a worthy adversary to him in the kingdom. Like if he's going over there to start his own thing, I mean, it's it'd be almost like competition. And then it seems like it switches from Silmarils being his focus to him doing what he wants over there and being a ruler. And it just seems like that kind of goes along with what you guys were talking about earlier, him progressively just becoming worse and worse. I just thought it seemed like his focus really shifted from the two different things there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we can see from he killed my father and I want vengeance And he took my Silmarils, and I want vengeance, and I want my Silmarils back, through, you know, the point where his selfishness becomes sort of more thoroughly crystallized and more thoroughly, you know, he becomes sort of more absorbed in that, not only in the vow, but also if you look at, you know, the very end of his speech, that just in the paragraph immediately before the vow on page 83, you know, but when we have conquered and have regained the Silmarils, then we and we alone shall be lords of the unsullied light and masters of the bliss and beauty of Arda. Now, who do we sound like? Who have we heard say this exactly, almost exactly that speech? Anybody? Yes, Mike's exactly right. That's exactly what Melkor wanted. He wanted to possess the light for himself alone, way back in the Ainur Lindale. That was exactly what motivated him, and he wanted to be master of the bliss and beauty of Arda when he saw it. So, I mean, that's... you know, and of course the text points out the irony of his, you know, great anti-Morgoth speech, and he's like ventriloquizing Morgoth all the way through. But here, Fëanor, you know, we can see his selfishness, you know, how Morgoth-like it has made him there. But I agree with Joe, it gets kind of worse than that. I mean, he goes downhill even from there. And here, I think, is where we can see sort of that parallel to Morgoth spending his spirit, that he really goes down. Remember when they leave... He brings everybody with him. He wants to bring all of the Noldor with him that are possible, even Fingolfin and Finarfin's followers, even though they're uppity and he doesn't really trust them. But he wants them all with him. And then when he comes to the Teleri, he's like, I need ships. Oh, and anyway, my strength for war against Morgoth will be increased if I can also bring the Teleri with me. Okay, great. So that'll be good. And then, of course, he's like, and also it will decrease the bliss of Valinor. Yeah, so then I can, like, you know, kick that in the Valar's face. That's a good plus, too. So that shows, obviously, that's a more corrupt desire than the desire to increase his strength to fight against Morgoth. But then when he's abandoning Fingolfin at the end, he is flying in the face... You know, so here we have, that is, his desire to bring the Teleri with him so that he, A, will be able to get over to Middle-earth more conveniently, and B, have more people with him to fight against Morgoth when he gets there. He's thinking in very kind of Machiavellian terms here, but at least he's still thinking kind of pragmatically and sort of sensibly in Machiavellian terms. By the time he is sort of maniacally cackling and setting fire to ships on page 90, you know, when he is described as Fey, he's even turning his back on his previously internally articulated Machiavellian plotting. You know, what I have left behind, I count now no loss. Needless baggage on the road, it has proved. And what do you mean, it has proved? You haven't done anything except try to travel, and they've been following you along on the shore. So again, nothing has been proved yet. Useless baggage? It's like more than half your army, stupid. So, I mean, yeah, he's not thinking even... Before, he was thinking immorally, but still rationally, and it seems like he's not even really rational anymore. So, yeah, I mean, here we can see a real decline, I think. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in kind of a good word for Fëanor.
Oh, good.
Since he's getting so little good press. I just wanted to mention, and I guess I hadn't noticed this before when I read this before, but that the line about his father, how he loved his father more than anything, including the Silmarils, I thought that's at least a glimmer of something hopeful for Fëanor, that he's not entirely bad.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's important to remember. And I think also an important thing sort of to use as context when we are talking about the vow and all those other things. We see, you know, he was not only was he not always consumed by selfishness, even recently he wasn't completely consumed by selfishness. His desire to take vengeance against Morgoth is not a completely corrupt desire. And, you know, his actions are in part motivated by a misguided reaction to his really genuine love for his father. So so that I think, I mean, even on the way, you know, to think about it in terms of honor, and I mean, he kind of appeals to this, you know, you have all lost your king, right? You know, are we really going to sit here when this guy, Morgoth, you know, if you want to call him guy, this guy has come in and he has killed our king and run off. We're just going to take it. Like, that's okay with us. You know, no, we're going to go and we're going to make war on this guy who has declared war on us by killing our king and killing my father. You know, and there's definitely something sympathetic there. Certainly if we're looking at things to not be wholly disapproving about Fëanor with, I think that's, you know, potentially one. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention too is, you know, when Mondo says, not the first, his cryptic statement, I always think, why didn't they ask him what that meant? You know, or are they just so used to Mandos making these cryptic remarks over in the corner or wherever that they just don't pay any attention to him and they say, oh, that's just Mondo's talking again. So, but, you know, I just wonder, why didn't anyone turn around and say, what do you mean, not the first?
Yeah. No, that is one of my favorite Mandos moments. I mean, I absolutely just, not the first, Mandos pipes up, you know, from the corner, as you say. You know, yeah, you sort of get the sense that the other Valar are like, you know, this is why we don't usually invite him to parties. But they did not understand his word. And again, there was silence. Nobody asks for clarification. Yeah. I'm not sure how much good it would have done.
Did anybody ever ask Mandos for clarification ever?
He pronounces his dooms only at the bidding of Manwë. And that is what we will generally say. He will kind of sometimes unhelpfully interject like this, but he rarely gives speeches, and we don't see a lot of people saying, I mean, again, you'd think, like, logically, you'd think, okay, we're in difficulties, we're not quite sure what to do, hey, how about we ask the guy who's never forgotten anything and who knows most of the future, can we bring him in here and get his advice on this? No, but people just generally don't do that. And I think that that's just part of who Mandos is. It seems to be to go along with his job, that he is silent most of the time. And that when he does speak, he often speaks. I'm not sure if cryptic is quite right. He's not cryptic in the same way that, you know, like the Oracle of Delphi is cryptic. I'm doing Greek mythology with my students, so I kind of got that on my mind. That is, it's not like what he says is like, oh, you can interpret it in multiple ways, and maybe, you know, people will interpret it wrong. It's not that kind of cryptic. But certainly his kind of unwanted and unexplained interjection here certainly does kind of seem odd. I do agree, you know, Jordan has just said in the text that he doesn't think that he would give a clarification even if asked, and I think that's right. If his job were to go around pontificating about everything that was going to happen in the future and everything that was going on that nobody else knew about, well, he'd be doing that all the time. But he doesn't. And that, I think, that's just part of who he is. Mike, go ahead.
The other thing that Mandos is doing there is sort of rebutting Fëanor, who's trying to predict the future, and he's interjecting and saying, no, that's not your job to predict the future, and he sort of throws in his two cents to sort of, I guess, put Fëanor in his place.
And I, you know, that's actually really interesting, putting Fëanor in his place, because it's true. The one effect that his declaration there has, nobody understands it at the time, but the one effect that it has is to kind of puncture Feanor's melodramatic moment there, right? And I shall be slain first of all the Eldar in a month. Not the first, actually, right? If there's one thing that he's communicating clearly, it is, Fëanor, you're not really as big a deal as you think you are. You know, you are already having delusions of grandeur right here. You are already making yourself out like you're the entire protagonist of this whole story. You know, like the darkening of Valinor is really, at the end of the day, all about you. And it isn't, actually. And of course, the rebuke is the more, you know, in retrospect, once we find out what it does mean and what Mandos Tolkis is thinking about, that is, the death of Feanor's own father, we see the kind of horrible irony it has for Feanor in that moment. Because there is one thing, it seems, that could get Feanor out of his shell and stop him thinking about himself, and that's his father. And that's, of course, what has happened, and that's the direction that Mandos' statement there is pointing. I think that's a really good reminder, Mike. I think that's very important. Joe, go ahead.
All right. Jumping ahead, kind of a little bit. It says that, you know, the wind seemed to answer Feanor's call, and when he was thinking about leaving Fingolfin, I was wondering, could that have been Iluvatar possibly aiding Feanor in his free will, since he seems to act randomly throughout the book, or could it have been the oath, kind of like starting to take its effect and shaping kind of what happens, you know, since chance doesn't really seem to be chance throughout the story. I wasn't really sure what to think there.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. Because that is a really fascinating moment. In the moment when Feanor is about to do, you know, like the sort of, is about to reach the bottom lung, the bottom rung of the ladder of his decline here, the wind suddenly rises as if, you know, and it's like, it's as if nature itself were obeying Feanor. Now, it's not, but, it's not obeying him. You know, he is not, in fact, commanding the winds. And I guess there are two things I think that we can see there in that expression. One is, this is almost like we're seeing this from Feanor's standpoint, you know, that a wind comes up which is able to waft the ships over to the other side. And Feanor, from his perspective now, he's gone past just thinking that he is the protagonist and thinking this is all about him. And now he's almost genuinely delusional. And again, I think we can see this in him being called Fey and everything. He's really, you know, Feanor's not entirely with us anymore, it seems. And, you know, here he seems to be genuinely delusional. Like, I can, you know, see, I am commanding the wind. I made this choice, and look, now, you know, all of, you know, the entire world is conforming itself to my will. So that, I think, is one thing that we can see. But at the same time, we know he's not commanding the wind. Who is commanding the wind? Well, we've got two candidates for this, right? One is Manwë, of course. Manwë is, you know, Manwë Sulamo, Lord of the Breath of Arda. The winds are Manwë's. So I think that one way in which we can see this is the wind that rises up, which, as I said, wind is a Manwë thing, could be, in a sense, an outward manifestation of the message that Manwë has already sent to Feanor. That is, Manwë has said, if you want to go, you can go. I won't stop. You can, you know, and, you know, and so that this is Manwë saying, you want to cross over to Middle Earth? Here you go. I'm not stopping you. Look at me not stopping you, right? Here I am. A wind is rising up just as you're turning to go. You know, look at how little impediment I have put in your way. I'm even wishing you good day, Feanor, and off you go. But there's something kind of, I was going to say horrible. It's not exactly horrible. I don't think horrible on Manwë's part. But of course, like, this is the moment of his abandonment of Fingolfin and Fingolfin's people. And I don't think that we're supposed to understand that either Manwë or Iluvatar are supportive of Feanor's decision here or affirming his decision. Joe, did you want to add something to that too?
I was just going to ask, so are you kind of ruling out the oath? Well, one more thing I wanted to say before that. You know, where Mandos kind of like says the curse or like the final band of the Valar. I think someone needs to read some of that, or you could read some of that, because that is really powerful. What kind of, they see Mandos up there and what he says there. It really kind of outlines everything. And then what relates to the question is, so are you kind of rolling out possibly the oath finally taking effect? Because that shapes so much history. So, I mean, are you kind of rolling out the oath and saying it might have been, it may have just been someone of higher power?
I think that there is, it's complicated because on the one hand, I mean, the oath is certainly in effect and we're told that the oath is in a sense going to bring things to pass. It's going to influence things, but I think not necessarily like that and not necessarily that directly. Like it's not going to create a situation where it makes the wind blow. but it is going to weigh upon them. I mean, the curse of the Noldor seems, the way that it's talked about, and we'll come back to this in a couple moments in the chapters to come, the curse of the Noldor seems to work on them almost like original sin. That is, they are like morally undermined by it. The things that they try to do go wrong. Joe, I'll take your suggestion. Let's read the doom of the Valar here. Page 88. Tears unnumbered ye shall shed. Notice, of course, already the memory of this that's going to arise later on when we get to the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, the battle which is just called Unnumbered Tears. That connection, not an accident. Tears unnumbered ye shall shed, and the Valar will fence Valinor against you and shut you out, so that not even the echo of your lamentation shall pass over the mountains. Ouch. On the house of Feanor the wrath of the Valar lieth from the west unto the uttermost east, and upon all that will follow them it shall be laid also. Their oath shall drive them and yet betray them, and ever snatch away the very treasures that they have sworn to pursue. To evil end shall all things turn that they begin well, and by treason of kin unto kin, and the fear of treason, shall this come to pass. The dispossessed shall they be for ever. Ye have spilled the blood of your kindred unrighteously, and have stained the land of Aman. For blood ye shall render blood, and beyond Aman ye shall dwell in death's shadow. For though Eru appointed you to die not in Ea, and no sickness may assail you, yet slain ye may be, and slain ye shall be, by weapon, and by torment, and by grief, and your houseless spirits shall come then to Mandos. There long shall ye abide and yearn for your bodies, and find little pity, though all whom ye have slain should entreat for you, and those that endure in Middle-earth and come not to Mandos shall grow weary of the world as with a great burden, and shall wane, and become as shadows of regret before the younger race that cometh after. The Valar have spoken. Wow, that is so good. That is just incredible. Things that I would do a sort of a quick emphasis of, I mean, just the things that really jump out at me as so important here. First, the connection that Mandos establishes here between the kinslaying and the turning by treason of kin unto kin, the turning of things to evil by treason of kin unto kin, and the fear of treason, shall this come to pass. Here he is saying, Mandos is not necessarily saying, I am going to act upon you in such a way that I am going to make you treacherous to each other, and I am going to inspire in you fear of treachery. But rather, this is a sense in which what he's doing is saying, this is the consequence of what you've done. That is now inevitable. It's now absolutely inescapable that you would be fearful of treachery now. That's what it means for you to do what you've done. Because you have slain your kin, now none of you will trust each other. Because you all know what you would do, what you have done, and might do again. So that's one thing that I think is really important. The second thing that I would point out is that the weariness of the world, as with a great burden, the elves fade, but the fading is not necessarily inescapable. The fading is not, this is a part of the consequence of the curse of the Noldor. Their fading is different. So I think that's a big deal. Matt, go ahead.
That was just, I had kind of marked that as maybe a turning point for the elves. I mean, it's all been laid out for them, the consequences of their actions, and they still have a long way to go. They're still having to learn. They've gotten this pronouncement, but they'll still have to learn through experiences what it really means. But I think when, for me especially, and maybe others, when you come to the Silmarillion from the Lord of the Rings, it's kind of it's hard to figure out the elves at the start, because in the Lord of the Rings, the elves seem almost like supermen and superwomen. They seem to be near perfect. They seem to be almost omniscient and to be so wise and very composed and serene all the time.
Right.
And as we go through the Silmarillion, we see the elves struggling with vanity and pride and betrayal and anguish and tragedy. And the events recounted in the Silmarillion kind of reveal how the elves became so wise because they lived through all the stuff. And these bitter experiences shaped them, and they molded them into people who have learned from their collective mistakes. So, I mean, they still have got a way to go, but this, I think, is a turning point for them in their history.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and here I would emphasize two things. One is, remember what Ilúvatar said back in the Music of the Ainur. You cannot, when you do evil, you cannot prevent good from happening. In fact, your evil choices, just as Melkor is before him, all of Fëanor's choices and all of the bad choices that are going to be made by the people who have followed Fëanor and all of the terrible consequences of the Curse of the Noldor are, in the end, going to bring about things that are more glorious than they could possibly have imagined. So, and I think that, Matt, that's exactly one of the things that we can see there. That's one of the consequences we can see in the elves themselves. They are going to be, in a sense, you know, in a sense better, in a sense improved by what happens. They will gain wisdom, and that's something that we see talked about even within the Lord of the Rings. The second thing I would mention briefly is that I think one of the reasons for the differences that we see in the elves in the Silmarillion and the elves in the Lord of the Rings, also another thing that contributes to it, is the fact that this is an elf story. This is an elf book. This is a story about elves by elves. The Lord of the Rings is a story which involves elves, but which is written by hobbits and from the hobbit perspective. So the elves look very different from where the hobbits are standing. Not just because they're so much closer to the ground, but you know, the elves seem greater and incalculable to them. Whereas, of course, from the perspective of the songs that the elves are singing about their own history, things look a little bit different. But anyway, that's sort of an aside. But I don't want to undermine, Matt, the really important point that you make about there is, you know, to use the phrase that Chris has typed out here, the wisdom that the elves gain is hard bought, and they do. They pay for it, but they do get what they paid for, which is wisdom and understanding, far greater, and compassion. Again, remember Nienna. Remember what happens when you suffer. Remember what grief can bring, wisdom and hope and healing. And I think that we do see that eventually. But Mike, go ahead.
Pick up a little bit more on the Mandos' judgment. I like the contrast to the first encounter between Fëanor and the Herald of Manwë, where the Herald arrives and Fëanor at that point is basically able to completely shout him down. And that's sort of for me, that's Manwë's sort of warning shot across the bow, and it doesn't go well. But then he brings out the big guns. He brings out Mandos, and Mandos utters his judgment. And then Fëanor is not going to shout down Mandos. He's left sort of muttering to his own people about, okay, well, he said what he said, but this is the way it's still going to go down. But I love the fact that this ongoing conflict he's having with Mandos, in terms of who can predict the future, who can make the future, Fëanor still gets the last word in when he mutters to his people and his followers, we're going to do some deeds here that people will be talking about to the end of time.
Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, turns out to be true. And again, we'll come back to that again. This turns out to be not only true and not a petty thing. This also is an important point. And to kind of to extend the point that Matt was making and that Chris was adding on to, it's not just their own wisdom that's going to be gained from this. It is also the wisdom of everyone who hears the stories about these times, the wisdom of all of us as we sit around reading it. We gain from it. Good can come for others as well as for themselves. So I think, you know, we shouldn't just overlook what Fëanor says there, but I agree with you. This is certainly not him having the last word, as he does with Manwë's messenger, in Tirion. But yeah, good. That's really important. Mike, I think I should give you another chance. You wanted to do style time again, right? I think it's time. And now we have style time with Mike Thurway. Go ahead.
I'd love to do style time. Okay, so I was rereading the chapter, and I started counting the number of times the word bitter appeared. And it turns out that I counted by hand 10 times that the word bitter appears. Characters are described as bitter. Paths are described as bitter. Battles are described as bitter. And then, as I was thinking about it, bitter, I think, has some association with, you know, the term biting or bite. And then it got me thinking about the fact that much of the action takes place around this ice that's described as teeth, that has the, you know, the grinding teeth of the ice. So that's also biting and bitter. And so I want to discuss when Tolkien uses the phrase bitter or bitterness 10 times, and he describes a landscape as a grinding set of teeth that, you know, bites people and bites characters. What is he doing there? What kind of bitterness is he talking about? What does that word mean?
I love that observation. I hadn't noticed that, you know, and it's interesting. If you had just asked, you know, like, what interesting word is used, like, you know, 10 times in these different ways, I'm not sure I would have, I'm not sure that I would have guessed bitter. I remember we talked about bitter in the previous, you know, bitterly did Mahtan regret the teaching, you know, to Fëanor or the skill of metalcraft. But yeah, you know, bitter didn't jump out at me, but you're right. I mean, once you bring it up, you're right. And it is interesting the number of different contexts that it's used. You know, the lies of Melkor, thou shalt unlearn in bitterness. And as you say, the battle with the Teleri is bitter. That's really fascinating. And it's, that does seem to be, in a sense, an appropriate kind of theme for this chapter. Because we see, of course, it's Fëanor's bitterness, which, you know, we see the bitterness that he is expressing in his initial moves, like, you know, sort of as he is going bad in the first place and his declaration of vengeance on Morgoth. But of course, also the greatest bitterness, I think, is the one that I just read, the lies of Melkor, thou shalt unlearn in bitterness. The results of all of this are going to be bitter. And the Noldor are going to be bitterly regretting the choices that they're making right now.
I would also point out Nienna mourning for the bitterness of the world at the top of the chapter.
Oh, that's fantastic! Yeah. As a kind of frame of the whole thing.
I love the framing of, you know, Nienna mourning for the bitterness, and at the conclusion of the chapter, they're in this icy landscape that basically is a biting landscape as well. So I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, it is very cool. The mourning for the bitterness of the world. Yeah, oh, that is excellent. Yeah, because I mean, this is one of the things that we can see. Remember, the discord of Melkor is worked into the fabric of creation. Remember, Nienna has been, you know, the lamentation was part of the song, you know? I mean, it's there. This is not, you know, so, you know, it's, you know, and perhaps actually it's sort of another example of a little bit, maybe, Manwë kind of being a little bit out of touch with things, you know, with the whole, like, you have stained Aman and you have brought suffering to Aman. Well, yeah, but suffering, that's not new, you know, that's not, yeah, I mean, it's, I'm not saying it was great, you know, those, it was like acceptable what Fëanor did, but, you know, the world is a bitter, but this is the way the world is. Nienna knows this, right? This is what she's weeping for. She's weeping that this is the way the world is, but it is the way the world is. And as they're, so, you know, when they are going to be looking back at this in bitterness, and as they're going to be experiencing, you know, this sort of bitter suffering through the rest of their days in Middle Earth, you know, this is part of the story. This is the way things are, not just as a result of Melkor's lies that he has been sowing there in Aman, but that itself was only a microcosm of what he's already done in the music. I think that's a really cool thing. Let's see, we're starting to run short on time. Let me see if there's a couple things I want to... Dusty, you wanted to talk about Olwë? I don't think we went there.
It wasn't so much... Well, Olwë called upon Oessig, but he came not, for it was not permitted by the Valar that the Flight of the Noldor should be hindered by force. But Unan wept for the mariners of the Teleri, and the sea rose in wrath against the players. Why was she able to do something and nobody else was?
Yeah, that is a good question. And but I mean, I like the way that it's phrased. Ase is prevented. And Ase, remember, Ase is the tempestuous one. I mean, you think if anyone is going to say, you know, screw what the Valar says, I'm going after Feanor and I don't care, you'd think it would be Ase, right? I mean, he's like, even he's worse than Tolkas. He delights in violence in a different way than Tolkas does. I mean, Tolkas at least is usually having fun with it. But anyway, Ase holds himself back, but it's Uinen. It's not framed, it's not phrased as if it's an act of defiance. You know, Ase doesn't do it, but Uinen, she doesn't care, and she goes ahead and does anyway. She mourns for the Teleri, and her mourning is the tempest of the sea. I mean, it's like she doesn't weep for them, and then while she's weeping for them, she also sends a storm. You know, the two of them are essentially the same. I want to make sure that I'm getting the phrasing right. I'm quoting from memory here and talking about this. But let's see, where's the
page 87?
Page 87. Great, thank you. Yes, yes. But Uinen wept for the mariners of the Teleri, and the sea rose in wrath against the slayers. And the sea rose in wrath, like the sea is doing it itself. Like this is the natural consequence of Uinen's tears. So I, you know, it's yeah, not an act of defiance. It is like, again, you know, I'm almost tempted to make a link back to, or I guess forward one page, to the Doom of Mandos. Just as Mandos is saying, look, the consequence of your treachery against your kin in slaying the Teleri is that now no one's going to be able to trust anybody. Now treachery is going to be, now it's like the way of life among you guys. Congratulations. Here, you know, this is the consequence. Like when she is, we, you know, the sea is mourning for what they have done. Like the sea is going to rise up against them. They can't expect that they're going to be able to be at peace with the sea, that they can just walk off with the ships. That's just not quite right, is it? That they can just sail away in the ships. It doesn't work that way because they have created enmity like with the sea itself, and you know, the sea itself responding to her, not to her anger, not to her vengefulness, but to her grief. You know, that's just the expression of the grief. You know, this horrible thing, you have done this horrible thing, you have done this sad thing, and it is going to immediately take its toll on you, and you can't escape that. Nobody can. So yeah, I think that that's I think that's what we can see there. Not that Uinen gets away with something that Ase doesn't. One last thing that I would want to leave, actually, just right there in that same paragraph, the Nol Delante. I would just point this out. The first of all, I love it whenever in the Silmarillion we're told about a much, much longer poem that's out there that we don't have right now, you know, which tells the whole real story of this. You know, so if you really wanted to hear the whole story of the kinslaying, you know, get somebody to sing the Nol Delante for you at some point. But the two things that I think are really important there is, first, what that means, the fall of the Noldor. The song which tells the kinslaying, the story of the kinslaying, is the song that is called The Fall of the Noldor. And who wrote it? Maglor, son of Feanor, wrote The Fall of the Noldor. So that, I think, is an excellent expression. And we can see Maglor, son of Feanor, his own recognition. This was when the Noldor went down. You know, this is the collapse of the Noldor here. And the kinslaying is the central piece of that. Okay, any other quick things before we go? Yeah, Laura, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that my favorite word in the entire Silmarillion is Helcaraxa.
Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful name. It's almost onomatopoetic, you know, the Helcaraxa, you know, the grinding ice. It sounds like grinding ice, doesn't it? You know, it's here, like the icebergs, you know, churning together. It is a fantastic word. I'm a big fan of Valakirka as well, but Helcaraxa is pretty hard to top, I agree. Okay, any final questions? Okay, thanks everybody. Yes, the Valar have spoken. Off we go. See you all next week for a chapter which is not quite so long as this week's chapter. So Chris, you don't have to start reading quite so early next week, as we will go back to Middle-earth. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Thus concludes Of the Flight of the Noldor. Join us next time when we return to Middle-earth and discuss Of the Sindar. This is Jordan Brown. And for myself and the rest of the Silmarillionaires, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.